From the Missouri River Breaks to the mouth of the Colorado River, this is Go West Young Podcast, the show all about America's public lands and the great outdoors. I'm Aaron Weiss at the Center for Western Priorities in Denver. Coming up, a conversation with Montana Senator John Tester. We will get his take on everything from the possibility of mining at the gates of Yellowstone to his favorite fly fishing spot. Our executive director, Jen Rokla, will join us for that. And we'll look back on a larger-than-life figure in Western history, Calamity Jane, born this week in 1852. But first, here's what's making news on our parks and public lands this week. Reaction came in swift and harsh from across the country to President Trump's executive order targeting national monuments. Editorial boards at the LA Tribune, LA Times, and Denver Post all weighed in. The Tribune said, quote, "The president's justification is built on factual sand," noting all national monuments, including Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante, were already federal land before they were named monuments. The LA Times talked about the extensive public input that went into all these monuments, and also the Public Lands Initiative bill that failed to even get a vote on the House floor. We've got a roundup of many more editorials on our blog, medium.com/westwise. On the heels of that, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is on his way to Bears Ears and Grand Staircase, starting this coming Sunday. Zinke was shamed into finally agreeing to meet with the tribes that led the effort to protect Bears Ears after the Intertribal Coalition held a press conference on Wednesday in D.C. They wrote to Zinke months ago asking for a meeting. The secretary instead met with county commissioners from Utah this week. Lo and behold, hours after that tribal press conference, the tribes did finally get an invite from Interior. We will keep you posted on all of that. Our guest this week is the senior U.S. Senator from the great state of Montana. He is a former music teacher, still a farmer, and also the owner of the best flat top in Washington, D.C. Senator John Tester, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Aaron, it is great to be with you, and appreciate the kudos on the haircut.
Absolutely. I want to start with this bill you just introduced. It would permanently protect lands around Yellowstone National Park from mining. Why is that so important right now?
Well, I think there's proposals out there for large based mines, and this is not an anti-mining bill. Look, there's places to mine in our state that's perfectly reasonable to mine. Out on the doorstep of Yellowstone Park at the headwaters is not the place where you want to put in a huge mine. So here's what this bill does, so your listeners will know. 30,000 acres, withdraw federal mineral rights on those 30,000 acres permanently. The mineral rights are there, and I looked at the maps, and it looks like there's about 120 acres through four sections that are in one group that people have mineral rights in federal lands, and that people bought those mineral rights up. And for private land, they can mine there too. But I think it severely limits the ability to have a large mine up there, which I think is a good thing. Why? It generates outdoor economy is 64,000 jobs, $6 billion a year. They shut down the Yellowstone River because it was too hot and fish were dying here last summer, and it was a lot of money. I mean, serious dollars, $500,000. So, and that was just like over 2 or 3 weeks. So, I mean, it has some incredibly important value. And I will tell you this: in the news, it was reported on today. I had said that Senator Daines had not gotten back to me, but sent him the map, sent him the text, and hadn't. Well, they had, like an hour before the press conference yesterday, just to make the record straight. But they got back, and they still didn't tell us whether they're on board or not. And so I have a coffee with Senator Daines, and we have a House member. That person will be a part of it, too. And I asked him what his problem was with the bill, and he said, I think we need to buy out those mineral leases that are on federal lands. Now, keep in mind, they can still mine those federal leases under this bill. And I can just tell you, I think that's really bad public policy. To side with the mining industry on this is not the right thing to do. This is a doorstep of Yellowstone Park. It's the headwaters to a very important ecosystem, the Yellowstone. And I think it's really important that we need to take a look back. Now, if we're going to do something like that and buy up those mineral leases, it'd be smart for you and I, Eric, Aaron, to start a little LLC and start buying mineral leases around parks, and we'd be rich in no time at all. So this is not the direction to go. This is land that's too valuable to the state of Montana, too valuable to our outdoor economy, and we need everybody on board on this bill. It was driven by folks on the ground, by businesses on the ground, everywhere from Chico Hot Springs to Sims Fishing Products to everywhere in between. And these are the kind of things you do for the next generation of kids, whether it's your grandkids or your great-grandkids or your great-great-grandkids. These areas have been around for a long time, and there's folks that want to go in and screw them up. And now, let me give you an example. Zortman Landusky had a mine in the 80s. That mine, the water that was shut down right after that, company went broke. Taxpayers have to pay for it now. But that mine throws out toxic water, so that water has to be treated for perpetuity. That means forever. Cancer rates for the folks that live around that water have gone through the roof. So this is stuff we have to be proactive before it starts, so we make sure that we have those ecosystems around for future generations.
Senator, can you give us some other examples of priorities you have on Montana public lands right now? I know you've got a couple of other bills, including the Blackfoot Clearwater legislation and legislation on East Rosebud Creek.
Yep. Yeah, and look, I think both these are really good projects. Once again, both of them are on the ground. Collaborative groups got together, hammered out a solution to a problem where everybody can win. And whether it's Blackfoot Clearwater Stewardship Project, you know, this project started before I got in the Senate. And it deals with timber, recreation, conservation. They all come together. They found common ground. And this is going to work it to get folks back to work in the forest. In fact, it already has. Plus, preserve some of the finest wilderness we have. Plus, provide some recreational opportunities for all Montana. That's what I'm talking about, a win-win-win situation. East Rosebud, very same, very, very similar. Community-driven initiative, collaborative process, and quite frankly, the designation of a wild and scenic river will help maintain the pristine conditions that we have on that creek, and really without impacting private land either. So this is good, and I think it's a positive thing. And like I said, the other thing is it's on the ground, folks. The other things that we're working on, continue to work on full funding for the Land and Water Conservation Fund. Continue to make sure that we're doing things for the Forest Service so they don't have to do fire borrowing, to make sure that our public lands are managed in an appropriate way so they have the resources to manage those lands. Considering always keeping an eye on this land transfer thing, because there's folks who want to transfer land from the federal government to the state, which in Montana's case would end up with that land being sold to the highest bidder, which I doubt there'd be many Montanans on that list. And our favorite hunting and fishing spots would go away. We're also looking at the cuts to EPA. Now, let me talk about this for a second, because EPA is kind of a dirty acronym. Okay, everybody looks at it and says, oh, those buggers, they're out there and they're regulating me and all this. They also do some pretty important stuff. First of all, they help hold industry accountable when they pollute. And they also help us clean up Superfund sites, of which we have three in the state. And then the last thing it does is it offers money for water systems to be able to treat water so people can have good, clean drinking water for their communities. And without good, clean drinking water, your community's dead, literally dead. So those are all things that we're working on, whether it's East Rosebud, Blackfoot Clearwater, whether it's wildfire funding, Land and Water Conservation Fund, or making sure the EPA can do the job that we want it to do. All critically important.
All right. Well, yeah, that answer was basically the outline of the rest of the stuff I want to ask you about during this interview. So we're going to get to, I think, all of them. I want to jump back one little bit because you mentioned sure. Senator Daines, your fellow senator from Montana.
Sure.
I know he's a co-sponsor
yep.
on the East Rosebud bill. You mentioned trying
yep.
to get him on board with the Yellowstone
bill. I think it's critical.
Yeah. Yep. How do you find middle ground when you're working with him? And is there a broader lesson here on bipartisanship?
No, I think how you find middle ground is you communicate. Now, here's the deal on the Yellowstone mine. We have a difference of opinion. And we're still talking about this, okay? I mean, it's not like, you know, we've got a good relationship. We're going to keep that good relationship. But he believes that those mineral leases should be bought out. I believe that the mining company still has the ability to go in and mine it, although they're severely deterred because they can't expand that mine into the nearby federal lands. And so he believes we should buy those leases up. I'm going to tell you the easiest way you kill a bill around here is throw $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000, I don't know how many $100,000 it's going to cost to buy those guys out, far more than they paid for the lease, I guarantee you that. And there's no money around. I mean, we can't even fund the FSA offices or essential air transportation or economic development in rural Montana. So the bottom line is that we have to come to a point where, and maybe we won't end up agreeing, but the bottom line is that we got to work together to move this forward. This is important for Montana. This Yellowstone mine mill is important. It may be one of the more important bills that I've carried in the last 10 years. And I'll tell you why. Because if we screw up that ecosystem, the economic effects on Montana are not in the millions, they're in the billions. And that's a problem.
I suppose that gets to the broader question of Montana's economic future and how do you balance out energy versus the growing recreation economy, as you mentioned. Do you get the sense that your colleagues in Congress understand that in terms of how rural economies can thrive going forward?
Well, I think it's a continually educational process, the rural versus urban and the divides that exist there. I can tell you that we can have it both ways. Okay, there's no doubt we can have it both ways, but it's going to take some planning to get that done. Look, I energy and affordable energy is critically important on my farm, and it's critically important for every business in the country. But so I don't want energy prices going through the roof. On the other side of the coin, I don't want to turn into Nevada on my farm in north central Montana either. I don't want to be that arid. We're arid enough. We need every drop of moisture we can get. So I think we need to be thoughtful when we go into this stuff. And my suggestion for energy would be, let's invest in the research to show so we can burn coal with as few emittances as possible. Let's see what we can do as far as utilizing the fuel called natural gas to be able to make some transfers, which also severely reduces CO2. And I think those are the kind of steps you could take to help move the economy forward from an energy standpoint and not destroy the environment in the process. The climate change issue is a tough issue. It's a tough issue for policymakers. It's a tough issue for folks on the ground that see their landscapes changing, whether it's in the ocean or whether it's on land. And why it's a tough issue from a policy standpoint is whatever we do here today probably won't have any visible impacts for decades to come. But I am one that believes that if we do some stuff here, some minor things, and I just talked about a couple of them, it'll help reduce CO2 so that in the future they won't have to do more draconian things that would really impact our economy in a very, very negative way. So I think we can have it both ways. I think we can support the resource economy. I think we've got to be smart where we dig holes in the ground and understand what the impacts of those holes could be. And understand that we also need energy, and we need energy that's affordable.
Senator Tester, you mentioned the Land and Water Conservation Fund. There's a lot of bipartisan support for it, but is there a path to permanent reauthorization?
Yes, there is. I've got legislation to permanently authorize and fully fund the Land and Water Conservation Fund. Here, in 1978, it was set up, just for your listeners, that $90 million, good sum of money in 1978, still a good sum of money. And I think it's been fully funded twice since 1978. This is money that's set aside to be able to help support our outdoor economy with access, allowing people better access to public lands, with cleaning up some of the checkerboard landscapes we have in the state of Montana, and protect some of the most pristine habitat we have in the 48 lower states, for sure, from the Rocky Mountain front to the crown of the continent, this stuff's been used. So the bottom line here is that this has been a very successful program for the last nearly 40 years. And it's something that allows us to be able to go fishing and hunting and access places that, unless you got a lot of money, these federal lands is where it's at. And there's a lot. Most people don't have a lot of money, so they don't have their own little paradise out there, but those public lands are our own little paradise. And so the Land and Water Conservation Fund is just another tool to be used to be able to maximize the consumer, in this case the sportsman's use, and I don't care if you're fishing or hunting or hiking or biking or whatever you might be doing, utilizing those federal lands in a way that that makes Montana a great place. And the other thing I would say is this, you know, in Montana we tend to take things for granted, especially when it comes to the outdoors and our outdoor environment. Being in this job as U.S. Senator, I've been around a lot of the country, and I'm going to tell you, and I say this with some bias, but there's no place like Montana. There's no place in the lower 48 like Montana. And we have ecosystems and landscapes that, quite frankly, are not going to be around if we don't take the opportunity to make sure our kids can enjoy them in the future. And the Land and Water Conservation Funds is one of those tools that are used to do that.
I suppose the other half of that is the land seizure movement, which it seems like the epicenter has perhaps shifted from Utah, where Ken Ivory was running the American Lands Council, to Montana now with the state senator Jennifer Fielder running it. Are folks like that taken seriously in the state, or are they viewed as more of a fringe movement?
Well, I think they're fringe, but I take them seriously. I'll tell you that. I think that there's got to be an understanding. We have a balanced budget requirement in Montana. Look, I wish we had it at the federal level, but we have it in Montana. What that means is that if you don't have a balanced budget, you start cutting until it happens. It costs a lot of money to manage these federal lands, these public lands. You turn them over to the state, they're going to cost them more than they're going to get back in revenue. What happens? You've got a balanced budget amendment. You got to sell them off. You sell them off, and sure, your budget looks pretty good because you don't have those federal lands anymore for people to recreate on, but you got a few bucks. But that's not sustainable over the long haul. And it ends up really changing our lifestyle in Montana and our outdoor way of life. Look, I think if we could, and this is probably where you're going next, Darren, but I think if we could deal with the wildfire borrowing issue and be able to use the money that's appropriated to the Forest Service for those folks to manage our forests, I think there'd be less lawsuits, and I think you'd have better managed land, and you'd have a better experience, you'd have better big game habitat, you'd have better fisheries. The benefits just go on and on and on. But for those folks who want to transfer that land to the state, or even just out and out sell it, because there's some that want to do that, to private entities, get it back on the tax rolls, I think it's a huge mistake. And the reason is because there aren't places like this like there were 100 years ago. It's made Teddy Roosevelt such a visionary. He saw this landscape, and there were landscapes like this all over the West, and he said, we need to preserve it. And we did it, and that's the reason we've got places like Yellowstone Park and Glacier Park. I think we need to look at it with that same Teddy Roosevelt kind of perspective and say, look, what's this place going to be like in 25 or 50 years if we do nothing? And I guarantee you that if we don't do anything, things won't get better. And for those folks who want to sell off the land, that's like dumping your retirement savings, man. It's like getting rid of all your safety nets. And when it comes to Montana, we get businesses that come to our state because of our public lands and our outdoor recreation opportunity. We get people that will work on our state for actually less money because of our public lands and our outdoor recreation opportunity. This is a winner for our economy in the state of Montana. So to sell these lands off or to transfer them to the state, big mistake.
So, Senator, speaking of the wildfire borrowing challenge, how does that pass the Congress? And is that something that can get past Paul Ryan in the House?
Well, it hasn't passed Congress, and it needs to pass Congress. I remember several years ago the Secretary of Agriculture from Iowa, and his name will come to me in a minute, but Vilsack, had us come over to the White House, and there was John Thune, myself, and some other folks. I remember John because I sat by him. And we talked about this proposal to get rid of fire borrowing, and 52% of the Forest Service budget's used for fighting fires, 52%, over half. It's going to go up, by the way. Another 10, 12 years, it'll be 66% of the Forest Service budget will be used for fighting fires. That's money that could be used to maintain trails, to harvest dead and dying trees, to do the work that needs to be done so we can, we can avoid, or at least partially avoid, some of the catastrophic wildfires that are happening. But we're not able to do that, so those wildfires happen all the time, and it's why I support the Wildfire Disaster Funding Act, which is going to change the way we pay for those fires. We're going to treat them like earthquakes or tornadoes or tsunamis or whatever they might be. These are a natural disaster. And so if natural disasters are not funded by the agency's budget, they're funded off budget through FEMA. and that's the way we need to deal with it. And I just think if we treat wildfire like any other natural disaster, we can allow more money to freed up to do the work that needs done on the ground in our federal forests. And that, if you take a look back into the 60s and move forward, you just see that more and more and more, and it's really happened in the last 25 years, how much more of the budget goes to fighting fires. Why? Because our climate's getting warmer. Fire season's getting longer. And they're starting earlier and they're going later. And I really think this is a bill whose time has come so we can keep the Forest Service budget whole and we can deal with these forest fires in a more common sense way.
Obviously, we've got a White House now that does not agree with you or science when it comes to the reality of climate change. Ryan Zinke, the Secretary of the Interior, is, I suppose, a moderate relative to some other folks in the administration. He was congressman from Montana. What's your take on Secretary Zinke so far, 100 days into the job?
Well, I mean, look, Ryan was a friend, still is a friend. I think it's too early to grade him. He has vowed to never support land transfers. I'm happy about that. And he's got to be able to back that up going forward. He's one of the guys that on my Yellowstone Mine Act, when I announced that I was going to make it a permanent withdrawal, he called me up and says, I want to be on board. That's a good sign. Now he's Secretary of Interior, and, you know, some of his language has to go through the Office of Management and Budget before he can make it public. But if that's in his heart and that's in his gut, I think he'll stay there. And we'll hold him to it to make sure he stays there. But you know, there's other things that make me a little more concerned. The monument review stuff has me concerned, not because I don't think monuments should be reviewed. It's what are they going to do with it? Because there's been some economies set up around some of these monuments that have been really important. And even if there hasn't been, if there's on-the-ground support for these monuments, we ought to be listening to those folks on the ground. And so that's part of it. You know, the coal evaluation stuff on our public lands, they decided to pull that off the table. That's about getting fair value for the resource. And it's not about not mining coal. I think that'd be a stupid thing to do. I think the best thing to do is make sure the taxpayers get a fair return on their coal that's underneath those federal lands, and we haven't adjusted that in over 20 years. So we he's done some things that I think are very, very good, and he's done some stuff that that I think it's too early to say it's going to be bad, but we'll give him a shot to succeed, and then we'll grade him from there, and that's what we're going to do.
So in addition to being a U.S. senator, you're still a working farmer. How does that affect your viewpoint as an elected official, and how do you take that viewpoint back to Washington, D.C.?
Well, for a lot of people, production agriculture drives them crazy. For me, it's therapy from Washington, D.C. I'm able to go back home, and I did this over Easter, and sometimes I'll spend all day and all night on the tractor to try to get stuff done, like I did Saturday and Sunday morning and into Sunday afternoon. But I've seen some changes, and the changes have happened due to climate change, I believe. We've got a little bug called a sawfly now. We never used to have one. I first started farming in the late 70s. He's got a little chainsaw on the end of his nose, and he cuts off your plants right before harvest time, and they fall down. Looks like they've been hit by a hailstorm. Well, there's been some research done to get sawfly-resistant plants, but the truth is we could be using that research for other things if we didn't have that little bug that doesn't die now because the winters are warmer than they used to be. Well, I talked a little bit about what happened in the Yellowstone River last year for when it was shut down because we had fish kills. I think I'm a farmer saying this, okay? I'm not a biologist. I think it was due ultimately because the water was too warm. And that's a problem. That's a real problem. And it's the first time it's ever happened in Montana, by the way. It's happened in Idaho before, but the very first time we've had a river shut down in Montana because of that. And like I said, the impact was $500,000. And that was a very short period of time. So, and the weather's always been unpredictable for people in agriculture. Montana weather, if you don't like the weather, wait a half hour. But I'm just going to give you a couple examples that have happened in the last couple of years. Last winter, not this winter, but the winter of 2015-16, and this is, I don't know what the reports say, but I'm going to tell you, I fly back and forth to the farm every weekend, and it was from January 1 on, it was warmer in Montana, where I live, than it was in Washington, D.C. It was colder than old Billy, back here. And it was warm in Montana. We had a very mild winter. And I think it's one of the reasons we had weeds that overwintered and we had diseases like we'd never had before. Now, this and usually we start seeding about the 1st of April. Back in 78 when I took the farm over, that's about when we started seeding, somewhere between the 1st and 10th. The last few years, there's been some years I've been done seeding by the 5th of April, starting March. And now this particular year, it's been a cold, wet spring. I still got a couple hundred acres to seed, and we're looking at the 1st of May right in the eye. And so there's a lot of weather variability. And like I said before, it's hard to say whether this is a natural occurring thing or whether it's something that man has caused. But as the old John McCain used to say back in about 2000, it really doesn't matter if man's caused it or not. We ought to act like that and take the steps necessary that we need to do to not kill the economy, not kill the energy industry, but really protect our environment and our climate for future generations. I spent a lot of time listening to the radio over Easter because I spent a lot of time on the tractor, and they were talking about the coral that's dying in the ocean. So it's not just a land thing. It's not just a Montana thing. Mother Nature gives us signs all the time, and all you got to do is open your eyes and see the signs. And if you are in denial, Mother Nature will fix it, whether you like it or not. And I think that we ought not be in denial about this. We ought to approach it from a very realistic standpoint and do common sense things that help not only our outdoors and our outdoor economy and our climate, but our economy overall.
All right, last question. This is the hard one. If you had to pick one favorite secret Montana road trip that you don't tell anyone about except for the listeners of this podcast, what's your perfect Montana weekend?
Hey, the perfect Montana weekend? Oh, my goodness. Well, and look, you guys want me to talk about outdoors. My perfect Montana weekend is having the grandkids come to the farm and be able to work with them on the farm.
All right.
My grandkids are 7 and 10 and 12, and that's my perfect weekend. Now,
we'll give you a pass on that one.
My perfect outdoor weekend is getting a hold of some of my friends in the Bear Paw Mountains and saying, can I come up and do a little fishing on Beaver Creek? And there's a lot of Beaver Creeks in the state, and there's one in the Bear Paws, too, Bear's Paw, too. And run up and down those creeks, catching little brookies. And I haven't done that in a long time. But I'm going to tell you, and I'm older now than I was then, so I'm not sure I can skip over the rocks and flip through the water. But I'm going to tell you, that is flat fun. And it's something that I really enjoy doing, but I don't get a chance to do it near often enough. But it's one of those places in Montana, everybody has their own thing. Somebody might want to go snowmobiling up in the mountains. Somebody might want to go mountain biking. Somebody might want to go bird watching. Somebody might want to go shoot an elk or an antelope or whatever. And all those things are great, and they're all fun. But if I was going to pick the one thing I really like to do, it's running up and down the streams with a little fly rod, oftentimes with a worm on it, not a fly, and catching a few fish.
Perfect. John Tester is the senior senator and fly fisher from Montana. Thank you very much for joining the podcast.
Aaron, Jennifer, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Let's wrap up with a look back at this week in Western history. This week is the birthday of Martha Jane Canary, better known as Calamity Jane, born May 1st, 1852. Her family joined a wagon train from Missouri to Montana, then headed south to Salt Lake City. Her mother died on the journey to Montana. Her father died a year later in Utah. So Martha Jane, at age 14, took charge of her five younger siblings. She worked whatever jobs she could find to provide for her family, from dishwasher to ox team driver, a dance hall girl, possibly a prostitute. She became a scout at Fort Russell in Wyoming. It was around that time that she got the nickname Calamity Jane. She claimed she rescued an army captain who got shot by Indians along Goose Creek, and he called her, quote, Calamity Jane, the heroine of the plains. Others claimed she never saw any action or army service at all, but was just a notorious character across the frontier. Who knows? Most of what we know about Calamity Jane came from her own storytelling, and almost none of it has been verified by historians. She settled in Deadwood, South Dakota, where she at the very least knew Wild Bill Hickok and Dora Dufran, the most successful madam in the Black Hills. It appears she had two daughters. In 1941, a woman claimed that Calamity Jane was her mother and Wild Bill was her father. She even published a book with letters purported to have been written by Jane. The only problem with that, historians all agree that Calamity Jane was functionally illiterate. No one ever found anything else she'd written down. In her later years, Jane bought a ranch along the Yellowstone River in Montana. Then she got married and moved to Boulder, Colorado, and started to appear in Buffalo Bill's Wild West shows, telling stories about her life. Those stories got wilder and wilder with each telling. Calamity Jane only lasted 6 months in Buffalo Bill's show before her alcoholism and profanity ended her stage career. Calamity Jane died in a small mining village near Deadwood at age 51. She is buried next to Wild Bill Hickok, whom she may or may not have been married to at one point. Four of the men who planned her funeral claimed it was a posthumous joke, since Wild Bill had, quote, absolutely no use for Calamity Jane while he was alive. It may be because Calamity Jane's life was so full of tall tales and so light on historical proof that she became a favorite character in 20th century westerns. Actresses from Doris Day to Ellen Barkin to Angelica Houston have played her. She first appeared in the Deadwood Dick crime novels in 1877, when she was still alive. Those stories helped create that larger-than-life reputation, even though they weren't based on any real events. She's a central character in Larry McMurtry's Buffalo Girls and Pete Dexter's novel Deadwood, which in turn led to the HBO series. Calamity Jane, who we can confidently say was born this week in 1852. That's it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please give us a rating on iTunes. It is the best way for new listeners to find us. And we always love feedback. Podcast@westernpriorities.org is where to send your love letters and hate mail. On behalf of Jen Rocola and all of us at the Center for Western Priorities, thanks to Senator John Tester for talking with us this week. My name is Aaron Weiss, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks.